Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Denise Heatherly, co-founder of Music City Animal Advocates, or MCAA, a nonprofit group whose stated goal is to create an animal-saving culture in greater Nashville and surrounding counties. Nashville is a great place for music, obviously, and a great place to live, but for a long time, apparently, it was decidedly not a great place to be an animal who wound up at Nashville's Metro Animal Care and Control Shelter. At one point, the kill rate there was said to be 78%. When Heatherly and her MCAA co-founder and many others were part of a grassroots campaign to reform the shelter, that served as a precursor to the Music City Animal Advocates. Their efforts were widely supported, including by the main Nashville newspaper and on social media, by such artists there as Kelly Clarkson and Miranda Lambert. Large-scale changes were implemented at the shelter, resulting in some dramatic results. So it's a bit of a case study and a great example for people in other areas whose local or municipal or county shelter maybe isn't quite up to snuff. So we'll discuss this sustained, successful campaign, what sort of issues Music City Animal Advocates focuses on now, and other aspects of the operation when I speak with Denise Heatherly in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Later, I'll also speak with Erica Sirotich, a local author-illustrator whose first book, Found Dogs, will be unveiled at an event July 22nd at Inkwood Books, where the Humane Society of Tampa will also provide animals that are up for adoption. Lastly, have you seen the movie Okja on Netflix? A remarkable film. Maybe we'll come back to it later in today's show or on a future program. But if you have Netflix and haven't seen it and you care about animals or just care about great films, I'd say cue that baby up. Right now, though, let's get to Denise Heatherly and Music City Animal Advocates with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is Denise Heatherly on Talking Animals. Good morning, Denise.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. And then yourself?
Just great. It's a beautiful day.
Good. Well, of course, we'll certainly be exploring the mission of Music City Animal Advocates and the initiatives and campaigns that MCAA concerns itself with. And along the way, I'll ask you to sort of guide me through the alphabet soup of acronyms for organizations that served as a precursor for Music City Animal Advocates and worked alongside the effort. But first, when speaking with the folks that help launch such organizations, I often like to explore their history, which sometimes reflects a through line of loving and helping animals since childhood. Occasionally, sometimes, though, it presents a dramatically different storyline. So let's get something of your story. Where did you grow up, Denise, and what did animals mean to you as a kid?
Oh, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, and I grew up with an animal-loving grandmother. She was the animal rescuer of her street, of her block. She always had an animal. My very first mother's assistant, I guess you would say, was a Dalmatian who just evidently hovered over me when I was a baby and watched out for me. And I grew up my whole life around my grandmother's dog.
So does that mean that there weren't other animals other than the grandmother's dog in your formative years?
Well, my mother did not like animals in the house.
We
occasionally, my dad was, it was his mother that was the animal lover, and my dad would always try to bring dogs home, but and fortunately he went to the local what we call dog pound back then and got them, but then we always found them another home. So I kind of grew up with this idea that, you know, you took care of animals in need and you could go get animals from the shelter and then find them a home.
Sounds like you were programmed very early in that way, but that's also kind of your example is sort of what I was alluding to before about people who sometimes have this big through line in their life of loving and growing up with animals, but some that I've spoken to over the years, either because one or both parents did not really like animals or feel comfortable with them, grew up sort of animal free, but later, maybe partly in overreaction or rebelling against that animal free childhood, became huge passionate animal advocates or rescuers or any number of other things. So
I think I'm a mixture.
Sounds like it. Thankfully, though, sounds like the grandmother's influence at least exposed you regularly to at least one dog at a time.
Well, I grew up, I was a child in the 50s and early 60s, and that, you know, back then, people didn't move away from their families. So we were very close-knit family and all lived near each other. I think of that as my grandmother's home is my home also.
Sure. No, that's great. And again, very fortunate for you in a number of ways, not just the animal way. But then since you were sort of a mixture, as you say, when you at some point left the nest, either to head off to school or just left home, what about your own situation? Did you have or want to have animals once you were sort of more on your own?
Oh, yes. Yes, I did. And when I was young and in my early 20s, my boyfriend brought home one day, just randomly, I saw him walking from the car to the house with a funny grin on his face. And when he came in, he reached inside of his coat and he pulled out a Weimaraner puppy. And he was so excited. And he didn't know that it had been, I had never told him that I had always wanted to have a Weimaraner, because my dad had always said he wanted to have a Weimaraner, and that never happened. So we ended up with two Weimaraners, and we ended up getting married and having those dogs. They both lived to be about 14, 15 years old.
For Weimaraners, that, if I'm not mistaken, at least, that's a pretty nice lifespan.
Yes, they had quite the life.
But isn't that interesting, though, that without, I guess, you guys ever having any discussion at all, that of all the things he could have brought home in, under his coat there to reveal that day, that it happened to be a Weimaraner?
Yes, and it was a great experience in getting to know that breed and their wonderful dogs. He did get them. We were living in Texas at the time, and he did get them from, I suspect, a puppy mill, which is, you know, something nobody knew about back in the early 70s very much.
Well, all the more that impressive maybe that they lived as long as they did, because unfortunately, as we all know now, dogs that emerge from puppy mills sometimes have medical issues or just aren't necessarily destined for the longest life expectancy relative to their breed. So it sounds like you guys got kind of lucky there.
Yeah, we really did. Well, you're right. Looking back, it was pretty amazing.
Okay, so you have these Weimaraners, you're married, you have a family, and at that point you're in Texas, it sounds like. So when did you end up in Nashville?
I moved to Nashville in February of 1980, and my husband came down here ahead of me. He bought our house in September of 79, and I've been here ever since.
And how quickly, once you got there, how quickly did you move with the Weimaraners, or were they gone at this point, or did you get animals once you landed there in Nashville? How did the animal part of that work when you'd relocated to Nashville?
Well, we had the Weimaraners, and then unfortunately, my husband and I divorced in 1986. And that was very near the end of their life, and he kept the dogs. And my daughter and I, eventually, a couple years later, were at the grocery store, and someone was in the grocery store at the grocery store giving puppies away, and we took one of the puppies.
And what kind of puppies were these?
No, this was a black lab mix.
And her
name was Grace. And that doesn't happen here anymore. That is now against the law. And this was part of my learning curve. And so we had Grace, and Grace just had a normal life being our family dog. And when Grace passed away, my daughter was a young teenager, and we just didn't have a dog for a few years. And then my daughter, who was a ballet dancer, decided to move to New York. And I was, Mom, I'm having problems with that. So she went to the local Humane Society and adopted a puppy for me. She brought him home, and I'm looking at him right now, and he's one of the dogs in the picture that I sent you. His name is Pete. He's now 15 years old. And once I had Pete, I got very interested in taking him places and socializing him, and I discovered an area where there seemed to be a dog park. and I started taking Pete to the dog park. And Nashville at the time didn't have any official dog parks. This was an unofficial dog park until some of the neighbors and the park board decided that that was not a happy thing, and they started giving us all tickets. And a small group of us got together, and we launched a campaign, and we campaigned to get dog parks in Nashville, and we succeeded. And there are now dog parks in Nashville, and that was my entree into activism for animals.
Okay, well, I want to explore that more, of course, but let's just back up for a sec. What were the tickets that were being handed to you and others? What was the infraction?
Having our dogs off leash in a park.
Okay, well, I guess that's pretty descriptive. Seems not very kind or generous. Wow, okay, so by the way, let me let folks know this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tune in, my guest is Denise Heatherly, co-founder of Music City Animal Advocates, which aims to serve the animal welfare and rescue communities in the greater Nashville area, and was part of a major effort to cultivate reforms at Nashville's animal shelter. So a very kind of illustrative example and information that we're going to get into a little bit momentarily here. But if you'd like to ask Denise a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So the effort that you and others that had gotten these tickets, I guess, banded together and sort of pushed for the dog parks. Now, was that by way of petition, by way of initiative? How did you actually get the dog parks approved when there really otherwise sounds like were not any in the Nashville area?
We did a lot of research, and we put together a document and explained the benefits of dog parks, not just to animals, but to the city and to neighborhoods and the park system. And we did some research, and we showed the need for it, and we went to the park the park board, and we asked to be on their monthly meeting agenda, and we presented this, and they did not they didn't seem very interested. And since we had been getting tickets in the locale and the neighbors were upset where we had been, we had found another spot where a group of us had moved our dogs to within the park that the park system didn't care about as much. And this area, actually, once the sun went down, had quite a bit of shady activity going on. There were drug deals, and there was some prostitution hookups happening, and yeah. And so we documented that, and we also researched how dog parks in other cities had displaced criminal activity, and we once again presented that, and we just happened to mention that, you know, we hadn't talked to the media yet, but, you know, they might be interested in this angle, and that got their attention.
Yeah.
Because they didn't want to be seen as condoning the bad behavior and not promoting something good. So then we all started sitting down at a table and talking, and the rest, you know, now Nashville has, I don't even know how many dog parks it has now, you know. So we got the area where we were meeting that was unsavory turned into a dog park, and they also opened two other dog parks. They all opened around the same same time, about 13 years ago.
Well, you know, isn't it interesting, though, that really, relatively speaking, not that long ago, 13, 14 years ago, that there was a park board or commission or whatever it might be at a different area besides where you are in Nashville that would resist a dog park? I mean, obviously, the certain parks or whatever have to be earmarked for certain activities, but this sounds like this was kind of like, initially at least, like, they didn't want any part of a dog park anywhere that was under their purview.
No, they didn't at first. They actually told us that they were already planning on opening a dog park, but it was way outside of the city. It would have been a place where people would have had to get in their car and drive to, like, right at the county line. And we said, well, you know, we're that's wonderful, and but we are interested in having city dog parks where people can walk to them. And I guess it was very forward thinking of us. I mean, here we are asking the people in Nashville to do something. Nashville is much smaller then. And we're asking them to do things they're doing in New York and San Francisco. And but, you know, Nashville has always been full of dog-loving people. Even yeah. though there were a lot of difficulties for animals in this city, it's just always been a very dog-loving city.
Well, I think just generally that seems to be the case. Of course, a lot of the musical artists that are based there, live there, et cetera, seem to really reflect that. We'll maybe come back to that as well. But also somebody amongst your group, whether it was you or someone else, obviously was quite savvy when they just kind of let slip to the board, or the park board, hey, hate to go to the media about the way you don't seem to care about what's happening over here, the unsavory thing, and meanwhile we can't get a dog park. So that seemed to really turn the tide, it sounds like.
Yes, sometimes talking to the media is a way to get the attention of the people in charge. It's not your best first shot, I would say, in activism, because then, you know,
can backfire depending on the circumstances and how the media is used and the issue at hand. So, no, you're absolutely right. But in this case, it sounds like it was exactly the right device at the right moment to turn things around.
Yeah. Well, and they had already seen all of our very painstakingly carefully done research and presentation. You know, I Leslie and I believe that is the best first line of defense, or offense, I should say, for the animals.
And Leslie, I should note, is your co-founder in Music City Animal
yes.
Advocates.
Yes.
And how do you pronounce Leslie's last name again? I know it's...
It's Ruffet.
Right, okay. Good. So now you have this kind of success with the dog parks under your belt, and you, as you said, kind of that was your entree into activism. So on a timeline from there, how soon did you and others start to turn your attention to Nashville's Metro Animal Care and Control, basically the shelter there?
Well, from there, I became familiar with animal rescues, and I became involved in animal rescue. And through talking to people and networking with people, I began to understand the shelter system and began to hear the grumblings and complainings about it.
So tell us, because it sounds like at least when this effort began in earnest, that the shelter there really was in rough shape. So tell us what some of the grumbling was about, or what some of the key issues that people seemed to be concerned or unhappy about there were.
Sure, and I will say, Across the board, across the nation, you hear the same stories. And it's what we kind of casually refer to as old school sheltering.
Well, that's one of the reasons, like I've already said in our conversation, that I thought this would be a great story for you to tell, because people could be listening online any number of places or later on the archive and maybe be in an area where a shelter is kind of still struggling or not, or maybe a bit old school, and hear some of your efforts and the successes that were later turned up that really revamped that shelter. So I think this is a great case study, like I said earlier, for people.
Well, the old school way, the animal comes in, they stay there in the legal, what the state deems the stray hold time, giving owners time to reclaim. And then after that, the decisions are made, and they were made without any particular policies or any definite standards. They were made according to the thoughts and the, well, I would have to say, and we do have a new shelter director now, so I'm not talking about the person that is directing now. They were made according to the whim. And I think a lot of people would say in their area that there's a lot that goes on according to the whim. And at that particular time, no pit bull that came into the shelter made it out alive unless an owner came and reclaimed it on its stray hold. If it was an owner surrender, it was a death sentence. There were no pit bulls that left the building, period, end of sentence. And then things would just be well, you know, that dog's too old. Nobody likes black dogs. And you just never knew what dogs would make it through. And very few dogs made it through at that particular time. And the euthanasia rate was 78%.
Which is staggering, right? I mean, that's yes. Sky high.
Yes. Yeah. That was sky high. And you know, it was worse for cat, you know, just, you know, any cat that came in that was scared or, you know, didn't react in a completely positive way was deemed feral, and no feral cats made it out alive either.
Wow, they had some pretty sweeping policies there at the time.
Yeah. Yes. And things have dramatically changed across the board, all across the United States, and groups like, you know, for one of the groups we work closely with is Best Friends Animal Society.
Great.
And, for, you know, so they've established a different standard that they're promoting, and they're also very supportive in helping groups, organizations turn their shelters around. However, at that point, this Best Friends effort had not really started on the widespread basis that it's on now. And so I got the big idea that I should just go and talk to the director and offer to help. And I thought, well, maybe if we offered to help, maybe they just need help and things would get better. But all that was met with excuses and resistance. And other people said, oh, yeah, we've done the same thing, and they're not going to do anything. And so at one point, I was on Facebook. This was in 2012. And I saw a post of a young woman had rescued a dog off the street, and she was at work when she did it, and it was not quite kosher to have this dog at work, and she was kind of under some pressure to get it somewhere right away. So she called the animal control to come get the dog, and she was working on getting it into a rescue. And once this dog was at the animal control, and this is before the changes happened, when she called them and said, okay, I found a rescue, they refused to give her the dog. They told her the dog was going to be euthanized. And so I don't know, that was the springboard. Both of us got together and said, and we named that dog Blind Baby because she was blind, and she was a sweet baby. She wasn't a puppy. And you know, we got together and we said, this is enough. We don't, you know, we're going to figure out an organized effort to change this situation.
How did that come together? Because I think that's got old school policies. You've got to clearly ineffective management. They wouldn't listen to, sounds like you went in very reasonably and said, look, we're happy to help. We're happy to do this. And just naysaying, it sounds like, all around. So since there was nowhere to go, and then the story about the blind baby thing, maybe as a capper, how did you then say, okay, we have to really mount a more serious campaign here? What did that look like, and how did you implement it?
Well, I put out a call on Facebook, and I said, does anybody want to get together about this? And boom, people started answering. And so a group of us got together. By the way, Blind Baby, because of the pressure we mounted, she did make it out alive.
Oh, good. I was worried yes. about that. How that story ended. Great.
And she went to Emmy Lou Harris's rescue.
Oh, nice. I was going to ask about that later, too, if we have time. But great.
Yes.
Okay.
So we just, a group of us got together. And once again, we launched our research. We had some really terrific people in the group. We had a lawyer. We had graphic artists. We had passionate researchers. And we just did our research. And we made a presentation in a nicely bound spiral format, and we asked for a meeting with the Board of Health, which our animal control is under the Board of Health, and we made our presentation, and you know, we were met with hesitancy, and the former director was there and kind of tried to give us the same excuses as to why we couldn't none of these changes could be made and how we just didn't understand. And so we consistently kept going to their monthly board meetings, and we decided that since we are met with rejection, that we did launch a petition.
That, I think, is very interesting because a lot of, especially in the animal welfare and moving to change things realm, a lot of really experienced activists believe that petitions, at least online petitions, have very limited effectiveness. And they'll point to just countless examples, even though you often see, of course, online petitions. But this would seem to be an instance of a petition actually being highly effective. Why was it so effective? What did it ask for specifically, and in what terms?
Well, it was in 2013, and it was, and petitions have kind of burned themselves out, you know, since then. So
yeah.
This was in 2013. And what we did was we wrote the petition and we asked for five things, which we asked for one of the things we asked for was the ban on pit bulls to be lifted. We asked them to start working, develop a system where they worked fairly and openly with rescues. At the particular time, they were only working with five rescues. And they had no particular, again, it was a whim thing. It was not, there was not clear policy. We asked for a volunteer program, which they, at that particular time, they had eight volunteers. And if you wanted to be a volunteer, they asked you to pay $90 for a background check.
Holy cow.
Yes. And I had volunteered with my daughter's ballet company, which was under the auspices of the city as well, and I didn't have to pay anything for a background check, and I was working with children. I mean, so
yeah.
You know, we kept chronicling all of our points, and so we put these five points up on the change.org, and when we launched the petition, we did a concerted launch. We all met. We had we had pizza and wine, and we started messaging, emailing, and tweeting people and asking them to support the petition.
Yeah.
So we kind of blasted it out there, and we got an immediate rush of support. And we did have people support the petition and contact the mayor at the time, which we actually had a great animal-loving mayor at the time. He had just never been asked to do this. And, you know, Kelly Clarkson supported it, Miranda Lambert, J.D. Souther, many people came forward and supported it. And, of course, the grassroots level of support was overwhelming and amazing. And they asked us to close the petition before we even got to all of the signatures we were going for. We were heading there very fast, and they said, Uncle, we're going to work on this.
Well, that's great, and I think as part of that, if I'm not mistaken, the key newspaper there, the Tennessean, I think, seemed to
yes.
at least cover it and support it, and I think there were some key musical artists that posted or tweeted social media in one form or another in support of it, so it just seemed like, yeah, this groundswell that really, obviously, forced them to cry uncle, that's what you were going for.
Yes, and that's exactly what happened, and it was just, it was like coming upon the Emerald City. We were thrilled. We were, in a way, we were even a little bit shocked.
You mean that it went so well, that it was so
yes.
effective? Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's a good problem to have, but it sounds like, again, part of what I think is interesting about this and can be applied to so many other situations, you guys were very organized, methodical, you had done your research, you had good materials, obviously the petition was really well assembled, and you had great support with all the tweeting and emailing and blast, so it really became a huge thing that they really couldn't ignore.
Yes, and I can't emphasize enough that doing the research is in having and documenting it and having your talking points at all times is a really important thing, and being able to refer to the document to back it up is really, really an important thing. So from there, the original group of people split into two groups, actually. One group that was skeptical and one group that was positive and said, okay, we want to jump into the deep end of the pool and support this effort, and the other group that said, oh, you can never trust government. And so we want to stand on the sidelines and watch. So Leslie and I jumped into the deep end of the pool and began working with the new effort and helping recruit rescues, and we started the Facebook page, and we trumpeted every positive thing that they were doing, and you know, the rest is pretty much history. It led to the former director retiring, and it led to a search for a new director that we have here in Nashville, Lauren Bluestone, who's just an amazing force of nature for animal welfare.
Well, that's great. Yeah. Sounds like overdue. We're in our last few minutes, and I want to cover a couple of things here, Denise. So tell me now what the shelter operation is like in terms of the changes that were implemented. Obviously, new leadership was crucial. Sounds like you love the new director. But beyond that, what sort of changes have we seen in terms of kill rate and just general policies, procedures, et cetera, in the wake of this effort?
Well, we are the way they do the numbers now is they like to do
save rate. Sure.
I still think in the old terms, and our euthanasia rate hovers between 8% and 11%.
Wow. Again, and at one time it was 78, you said, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so look at that. Jeez. That's a dramatic difference. Over how over what number of years did it go from 78 to this new number?
Well, it was 78 when we started. When they implemented the changes in 2013, through that year, it ended up being about 46%. So there was that immediate. And then from between 2013 to now, it's gone from, you know, like 46% to, you know, let's say an average of 10, 11%.
Wow. You guys must be so so thrilled and impressed with seeing, I mean, that's as important a number as there is in the shelter world. So that is great. Well, let me just let folks know we're in the final moments. This is Talking Animals. We're speaking with Denise Heatherly, co-founder of Music City Animal Advocates, which, as you've been hearing, is devoted to improving conditions in animal welfare and rescue communities in the greater Nashville area, and specifically really helped with a big combined effort to reform the Nashville shelter there. So just in our remaining moment or two here, Denise, what are some of the prime interests of Music City Animal Advocates now that you obviously had that kind of success with the shelter? What else are you particularly focused on at the moment?
We have been working on an effort to improve the what's called the Community Cat Program. One of the reasons the numbers are able to go down at the shelter is they now don't automatically say, oh, feral cats, that's it. You know, you're not friendly. Goodbye. So we wanted to find a balance. Community cats are feral cats, and they're friendly stray cats that come in that nobody knows who they belong to. They've been living outside, and some of them might be lost cats. So we're working with the shelter now to, instead of just letting them all back out onto the street, putting kittens back out on the street after they've been fixed, we're working with them to provide solutions for animals, cats that may not fare so well on the street, and working on, you know, sorting that out. Who are the true ferals? Who needs to go into adoption? You know, finding placement for kittens and not making kittens fend for themselves.
Oh, that sounds great. And one sort of last thing, because I know this was kind of crucial to the efforts to help reform the shelter, but just on an ongoing basis, it seems like a lot of Nashville-based musical artists are real animal people, some of whom I've spoken on the show. Emily Hurst, for example, and you alluded to earlier, has her own dog rescue and has for a number of years Bonaparte's Retreat. What other Nashville artists are deeply committed to animals and animal causes there?
Well, Miranda Lambert is.
Yeah. Doesn't she have a shelter or a rescue of her own as well? Or
she has an effort called Mutt Nation.
Yeah, Right.
And she helps renovate and, shelters, helps give a financial boost to shelters that need different accommodations to improve their services and improve conditions and chances for animals to be adopted.
That's
and,
great.
And then a lot of the musical people are just plain old animal lovers. And, you know, I met J.D. Souther at the dog park, and he's just a huge, longtime animal lover. He doesn't have an organization, but, you know, he just loves his animals.
Yeah, well, and I believe he was one of those that stepped up when you guys were in the midst of trying to get support for that petition. I believe he was one of those that got involved on social media and registered his support.
Yes, he did.
And I think, Kelly Clarkson and some others did the same. So, so it's really nice to hear. And again, when people like that use their name and kind of star power or whatever to help push something like this forward, I think that was part of what you saw as why that was overwhelming, that they just couldn't ignore you guys and the petition anymore. It just had such a broad base of support, but also some notable names that were part of that.
Yes, it did bring it to the light.
So, Denise, we have just about reached the end of our time, but I've really been enjoyed speaking with you. This is Denise Heatherly from Music City Animal Advocates. There's a website, musiccityanimaladvocates.org, and also a very active Facebook page. You can just search for Music City Animal Advocates. So, Denise, thanks so much for making the time to join us today on Talking Animals.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it so much, and I can't wait to share the broadcast with our followers.
Cool. All right. Well, again, I do think it might be helpful, just what you outlined for how you did bring about that kind of change at the shelter.
Yes.
So, yeah.
And if people want to find us, Music City Animal Advocates on Facebook, and contact us with any questions, we'll be more than happy to answer.
That's great. Okay. Thanks again.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
In a few moments, I'll speak with Erica Sirotich, the local author-illustrator whose first book, Found Dogs, will be unveiled at a dog adoption event held at Inkwood Books on July 22nd with the adoptable dogs provided there by the Humane Society of Tampa Bay. What a great combo! Right now, though, it's time to step into the comedy corner with a piece tied in some ways to my conversation with Denise and my forthcoming conversation with Erica, for that matter. This is Adopting a Dog from Greg Fitzsimmons in today's comedy corner on Talking Animals.
So we rescued a puppy, which is great. You rescued a puppy before. Okay, beautiful. It's a great thing. Millions of dogs are put to sleep every year because there's not enough homes. And you go in and you're a hero. You go save one. You walk in there and you think it's going to be easy. You're like, I'll take that one. They're like, oh, not so fast, asshole. First, you got to fill out this 28-page application, right? Name, social security number. If you and your wife divorce, who gets custody of the dog? I don't know. We never talked about it. Thanks for planting that seed for us. And then they set up a home inspection. I'm not making this up. Literally, woman shows up to my house. Clipboard, little beard, light beard. Didn't see it at first. And now she's looking around my house while I stand out front waiting. Just nervous that she's going to come out and be like, yeah, we're just going to go ahead and kill the dog. Doesn't feel right to let him live here the way you do. Take him out back and just shoot him. We feel pretty good when we rescue a dog, don't we? Right? We feel like heroes. Meanwhile, there's two types of shelters in the country. There's shelters for dogs, the Humane Society. Shelters for people. Halfway house. Not even a whole house. Half a house. And then we rescue from the other one. We grab a dog, we bring him home, and we wash him, and we fix him. We bring him to bed, we pet him, and we hold him, take him for a walk. And then we walk around a human that's laid out on the sidewalk to pick up from the dog that we rescued. What's wrong with that picture? Why don't we rescue from the other place? Just go in there, I'll take that guy, bring him out. Take him home, give him a steak and a shave, a little corduroy bed in the corner. Come on, Freckles, let's take a walk. It's Dennis. I told you my name's Dennis. Freckles! Come on, let's go outside. Been outside a lot. Kind of want to stay inside for a while. Your friend comes over. He's cute. What is he? I think he's Dutch.
Okay, that was Greg Fitzsimmons with a piece called Adopting a Dog, taken from an appearance a few years back. Now on to my conversation with Erica Sirotich. Indeed, I'd like to welcome Erica to Talking Animals. Good morning, Erica.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. So let's talk a little bit about you and the sort of work that you had done leading up to the book. And we'll talk about the book, and then we'll talk about the event on the 22nd. So,
okay, great.
Yeah. So give us the nickel tour, at least, of okay. of you and your work as an author-illustrator.
All right. Awesome. Yeah. I'm an illustrator living in St. Petersburg. I've been illustrating professionally for 8 to 9 years and working in books for about 4 years. I'm from the Sarasota area. I actually went to the Art Magnet High School in Sarasota, Booker High, which was fabulous. And I graduated from New College. And for a few years, I tried a few different things, different career paths, but I circled back to art, something that I had been doing my whole life and enjoying. And I've been illustrating ever since.
Cool. So tell us, now that we have at least a little sketch of background, tell us about Found Dogs.
Okay. Found Dogs. So Found Dogs is my debut picture book as both author and illustrator. So I've illustrated some other books for kids, but this is the first one that I've written. It's a picture book for kids aged about 2 to 5, and it's about adopting dogs from the local shelter. It's technically a counting book. So what happens in Found Dogs is the kids count up the dogs at the shelter from 1 to 10, and then they count them back down as they're adopted from 10 to 1. So all of the dogs in Found Dogs are united with new families.
Well, that sounds pretty neat.
Yeah, cool. It's fun.
Nice. So how does it feel being both author and illustrator this time around?
It's cool. It's amazing. It's definitely, it's different from being an illustrator. It's kind of like you're a one-woman show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did deciding to fill both roles on a book about adoption, does that reflect a love of animals or a passion for animals?
Yeah.
It seems like you could have done author, illustrator in any number of kinds of books, but you chose to.
Right, right. Yeah, I've always been an animal person and a dog person, particularly. Found Dogs was sort of inspired by my own dog, Russell Redfur, who I adopted 10 years ago. I just love dogs so much. And there are a lot of picture books out there for kids about dogs, but there aren't many picture books about shelter dogs. And the ones that I'm aware of kind of have a melancholy tone to them. So I kind of wanted to tell a story of dogs getting a second chance and finding their families in a way that was heartwarming and upbeat and, like, appropriate for the littlest kids, because this is a book for, you know, kind of that 2 to 5, 2 to 6 age group.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to show the shelter as, like, a friendly place. You know, there's nothing scary. It's just a wonderful place to go meet that new, you know, that new best friend.
Neat. Yeah, well, I think great to plant that idea in that age group for a bunch of reasons. And just as an aside, with your own dog, I just always love dogs that have a first and a last name, by the way. But anyway, so tell us a little bit about the event on the 22nd.
Yep. So it's at Inkwood Books in South Tampa, and it's my book launch party. So it's the very first event for Found Dogs and the only one that I currently have scheduled in Florida. It's at 4 p.m. on July 22nd. This is Saturday. And we're going to have a story time. We're going to do a little reading of Found Dogs for the kids. And then I'm going to do an interactive drawing demo, like up on an easel. And I'm going to try to get the kids involved in that. And I'll sign any books that people buy. And kind of what I'm most excited about is that we are going to have some adoptable dogs on site from the Humane Society of Tampa Bay.
That's great. And do you have an idea about how many dogs will be on hand for?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm guessing it's just a handful because the venue is not huge.
Yeah.
So,
but still, it seems great. Yeah. And with any luck, one or more will find a home.
I would be thrilled.
Yeah. You'll have to immediately start working on the sequel, I guess. But
Found Dogs. Yeah. I'm hoping the sequel is going to be about cats.
Okay, that seems equal time. I like that.
Yeah.
So Erica, is there either a Facebook page or website or both where people could find out more about the event if they want to follow up later or didn't catch all the details as we were chatting
there
about
is, them? There is an event page for the event on Facebook, and I can post that on the Talking Animals page so that people have access to it. Yeah.
Okay, great. And if they wanted to search for it otherwise, I guess they could search for what
Found
Dogs or...
They can search for Found Dogs. They can go to my website, which is just my full name, ericasirotich.com. I know that's a little tricky, SIROTICH.com.
Great.
And then there's an event page there, and it lists the events. I'm also going to have some events in California in August because I'll be traveling out there. But the 22nd Saturday at 4 p.m. at Inkwood Books.
Great. And the Inkwood Books, by the way, 216, sorry, South Armenia Avenue. And so great. All right. Well, I think we got the whole lowdown. And thanks, Erica, so much for joining us. And good luck with the book.
Thank you so much, Duncan.
You bet. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Coming up at 11 on WNF, it's Rob Lori in Radioactivity, kicking off a three-hour block of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, including in the noon hour, Midpoint with Nola Lule. Then at 1 p.m., Craig Kopp presides over executive session. Meanwhile, on this show is the prize for Name That Animal. I'll be offering an animal-related book I'll pick from the vaults, some book that we've discussed on Talking Animals and interviewed the author. That'll be our prize for Name That soon. So let's get in and name that on the team right now, in fact. So this is a giveaway, but please only participate if you haven't won something from WMNF in the last 90 days. And again, you can win some cool animal book that I will select for you. The first person who calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal song, it's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals. Okay, the question is, can you name that animal tune? If so, we'll probably take your call off air, because we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals. Rob Lori is up next with Radioactivity. I'll be back next Wednesday, July 12th, and my guest will be Ronnie Lee, a veteran animal rights activist, perhaps best known as the founder of the Animal Liberation Front, which some critics and some governments even have labeled a terrorist organization. Lee is the focus of a new biography called The Animals Freedom Fighter. Please visit talkinganimals.net for audio archives of every show we've ever broadcast. iTunes podcasts are available there too. There are also links to our Facebook page, Twitter feed, and more. Please like us on Facebook, the show, and especially me personally. And follow me on Twitter. You can also subscribe to our e-newsletter to find out about our guests a couple of days beforehand and other scintillating news from the Talking Animals world. That's all found at talkinganimals.net. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. This is Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weeki Wachee and beyond. Community conscious radio, homegrown, handpicked music and news. Thanks so much for listening. Speak again next Wednesday at 10 a.m. on Talking Animals. Thanks.